guys, and welcome to your Una series podcast. Today, it's a treat for me and for you. I have an incredible guest. Her name is Megan Woodard Kennedy, or Kennedy Woodard, whichever way.
You should know this by now.
Yeah, it's true. I put Kennedy Woodard. She is. Let me introduce you to her. She is a lot, so I'm going to read it so I don't mess it up. But she is a coaching psychologist, which will define exactly what that means. She is a co-founder of The Climate Psychologist. This is an organization that provides psychological support and communication tactics for individuals, families, governments, and corporations who are committed to saving the planet. That's a lot. But also, I want to show everyone that you are also the co-author of an amazing book that came out just last Friday. Ready for it? It's coming. I am one of the lucky ones who has a copy. It's called Turn the Tide on Climate Anxiety, Sustainable Action for Your Mental Health on the Planet. So this is an amazing book that we'll discuss a little bit further on this podcast. But in a nutshell, it explains to you what is your eco-emotions, what is climate anxiety, the diagnosis, what are the signs, how could you recognize it in yourself, and more importantly, what to do about it. Hear it and show it again. Megan, thank you so much for joining us. This is really sweet of you.
Me.
I know that
such
you're
pleasure.
Very busy, especially just after the launch. I'm sure that
very
you
exciting,
are
very exciting, but always time for you.
So listen, what I would like to do for everyone first, if you don't mind, is define those new semantics that is coming with this process of climate anxiety. I will just name three, but two first, eco-anxiety. And what is eco-emotions? Let's start with eco-emotions, and we can maybe dive into what eco-anxiety can be. How would you define it?
So it's important to note that it's not a medical health a diagnosable condition. And most people feel that this is appropriate because it's actually a normal human response to the biggest existential threat that we've faced. So it shouldn't be classified as a mental health disorder. There's the other side of the argument that actually if it were, there would be more funding for research, which would be a positive thing. And also insurance companies and providers and things like that would be more willing to provide care for this. But actually we're seeing that they already are starting to allow for this. So it's kind of what eco-anxiety isn't is that. What it is sort of an umbrella term for, like you said, all of the emotions that can kind of come and generally associated with negative emotions, like climate guilt, climate grief, climate despair, anxiety, anger. And again, these are all emotions that we really want to normalize in this because it's a very emotionally provocative subject. It's you know, the very way of life as we know it on this planet. So it's normal to have these responses. And although, you know, there have been many, many who have experienced this, you know, for a very long period of time through either colonialism, things like that, actually, and I think it was about 2019 that Gerst said the term eco-anxiety or climate anxiety sort of hit pop culture mainstream. So we were suddenly seeing it on fast food menus where people were able to now order the Impossible Burger, or in Big Little Lies, they're talking about their children having eco-anxiety or forest fires being covered, you know, things like that.
So hang on, that brings me to you. When did you decide, because you're a coaching psychologist originally, so you were helping people with other kind of disorders and anxieties and fears and all sorts that were not necessarily linked to the climate, right? So did that come from the patients you were seeing? Did it come from people around you in your community? Or maybe at the same time, did it come from you? Did you start having those emotions and thinking, okay, what am I going to do with it? Being a practitioner yourself, so okay, let me just fix myself and then I can try and fix others. How did that happen?
I mean, I think you've just described the exact process, fun of us. It was interesting. It all sort of collided together at the same time. We had sort of our client zero, if you will. Our first person, we had a traditional practice in Oxford, England, where there's a lot of work in sustainability and research. So we've started to have people and clients present with, their inability to be present, to do their jobs, to disengage from the emotional impact of their work because they were so sort of on the front line of that really difficult information right there. At the same time, I joined an eco club with my kids, and I noticed that the parents were really struggling with how to talk to kids about climate change, how to do climate work, how to manage their own emotions. And then I went to your living room, and that was a talk hosted by some Extinction Rebellion people. And I actually hadn't really processed sort of the gravity of the situation deeply. And after that, I sort of went on my own emotional journey, found out what worked for me. And at the same time, my partner, Patrick Kennedy Williams, who's a clinical psychologist, we really sort of just developed an idea that there wasn't sort of a pathway for this. At the, you know, there were, it's not something that you want to challenge. You don't want people to feel better about it. You want people to feel empowered and engaged. So sort of the marriage of clinical psychology and coaching sort of process your feelings, get to the root of them, but then the coaching, what are you going to do about it?
What do you do about it? Exactly, which I love. Well, we'll come back to the book in the second part of this podcast, because this is really what you also, I'm going to show it again. This is what you kind of explain to us.
But makes my heart flutter every time.
You said before there was quite a few different kind of emotions. You talked about anxiety, about despair, about anger, and I would like to define some of them, because I guess what's interesting now is that this is all relating to all of us, apart from the real people who say, I don't give a damn about it. That doesn't exist. You know, the real people, I guess, who don't even believe there's a climate change. But let's put them these aside. Everyone else, I mean, I don't know what to do with those. Maybe you can tell us. But then let's not talk about this, because that denial of science is another process. But with the people who are now seeing it, because I think the big difference, this is what I'm related to us now. You know, I can excuse my parents for not acting upon a change, even though there was a beginning of sensibilization about a change that was happening. They just felt whatever. You know, the earth is big enough, it will take it. The cars, the plastic, the whatever. Then comes to us this transition from food, from understanding all the pollution that we were doing, we were polluting this planet. Yet again, as a kid, I was like, yeah, you know, I'm not going to put some paper outside, put them in the bin. But that was pretty much as far as, and I wasn't guilted about it. And then within this 15 years, this, which is really short if you think of it, I'm not even talking about the last five, now it's also the guilting. So something I want to discuss with you is where and how people deal, because this is my problem in my community, with knowing but not doing. Because this is our biggest question, even with my wife that you know really well. She is engaged, she's an activist, you know, her whole power is into this. But how do you change your habits, first of all? If you have any tips for that, but also what do you do with that feeling of knowing yet not doing, because it's difficult.
So it's an interesting, it's a really interesting subject that we need to address, because for one thing, we have a lot of defense mechanisms that come into play when we talk about climate communication, about, you know, actually seeing climate change, seeing plastic pollution, seeing cars polluting, you know, when we actually take in the information, but also the experience of it as well. And so, you know, I think we say that, you know, when these emotions come into play, like anxiety or guilt or denial, there's always room to just nod to them without necessarily bowing to them. And what I mean by this is that a little bit of eco anxiety can promote action. A little bit of ego grief can make us hold ourselves accountable and stand up to our values and show up for the work that we need to do. And so a little bit of denial allows us to get out of bed every day and function. And so it's holding the balance for what our, you know, what our, and then that's where sort of the coaching comes in, of having really clear, actionable goals. So that we are able to manage the other stuff around it, giving up the myth of perfection, but still showing up.
I like this, but also because of the idea of exemplarity, we are scrutinized a bit into not doing the right thing. Once you've said, you know, if you're exposing yourself to the society saying, I am now really thinking that we have to do something, then people just pinpoint on the one thing you haven't done. So I feel like if you do, then once you've, I guess, proclaimed yourself, not even an activist, just like, I want to do something about the planet. People are like, oh yeah, go on then. And then you start doing stuff. And if you've done 95% of the right thing, they will say, oh yeah, but I came to your house and there was a bottle of plastic. So, you know, and you feel like, hang on a minute. This is not me trying to, this isn't a competition. You know, I'm just trying to do what I can. It's my best. I don't know. I find this very quite difficult when you start to engage in the process. Yet you were saying about the defense mechanism, everyone else, they feel so guilty for doing nothing that you just want to finger point at the few things that you haven't done.
Yeah. And again, that's displacing all of those emotions that they are, you know, they're aware of, they're not doing enough or aren't actually aware of how big the crisis is. So again, it's giving up that myth of perfection. Anne-Marie Bonneau, who's the zero waste chef, says we don't need one activist, or we need one doing I messed that up. She said it better than that. We don't need one person doing plastic waste perfectly. We need millions of people doing it imperfectly. And we also need to hold account of the systems that we're a part of. You know, this is the placement and the responsibility is placed on the individual in a very calculated way through disinformation campaigns from fossil fuel industries and politicians. It's like, you need to do better. It's like, actually, I'm doing everything I can. You're the we voted for you. We've met. And so that's where we can have a bigger impact, is putting pressure on those wider systems.
What do you find mostly? I don't know if you've done like a data collection, but is it when it comes to the emotion that is, you know, finding a disbalance between a bit of denial that allows you to just carry on with your life and not feel totally overwhelmed by it, but also a bit of anxiety and maybe a bit, not anger, but a bit of, so that you want to do something. What do you find most? Because I find climate guilting is something that is difficult as well. And that, I think, triggers that defense reaction in others. So a lot of our communication, and I see it, you know, because it's quite close to our family, I can see some of our groups in our community think, oh gosh, you know, Boniface and Arizona again, oh, it's all going to be about sustainability or whatever. You know, I can see them thinking, it's not pushing us away too far, but just a bit on the side. And I'm thinking, do you think that is mostly the self-guilt turned into some kind of, as you said, anger, or is it real fear of being found out for not doing much? You know, what do you find?
You know, I think it's one of those things that, again, sort of communication around climate change hasn't told the stories in a way that's productive. So there's a real narrative that exists. And part of the problem was there was the sort of information deficit model of scientists believe someone doesn't have the information they need. They say, this is the information that's here. This is the science. This is what needs to be done. This is what you need to do about it. And this is where people fall off. And scientists are like, oh my God, why isn't this?
I don't know how they carry on.
And so part of what we say is that we have the technology to save us, but not without the narratives that engage us. And so when we're approaching people at a dinner party, it's opening up those conversations in a new way. We want to make it sexy. We want to make it fun. You know, it's like actually people don't want to be told what to do or what they're doing wrong. And that's where those defenses, you drove here today, didn't you? It's like, actually that's when they'll highlight all the things that you're not doing, because it does shine light on their own incongruence in their value of what they're doing. It's kind of this dissonance, this cognitive dissonance that happens, that I want the world to be a better place, but I also don't really want to change my day-to-day lifestyles. And when we anchor on to things like values and objects of care and really identify with our story, our narrative about why climate change is something that we want to take, you know, action against, that's when that dissonance sort of subsides and our motivation and our ambition overrides that.
Do you find that people sometimes don't want to make the change that they feel is not exactly their fault? You know, they feel it's the people before me who did this and they enjoyed having three cars and a huge 4x4, you know, whatever it is that you then projects in your mind that people had so much fun doing that you can't do anymore because of, you know, what can we do? What is that?
I think there's two things there. There's emotional adulting, which we have to do. Like, yeah, they did it, but just because, you know,
when we were
young and we got home and our roommates had a big party and we're like, oh, I've got to clean up. But it's like, actually, I don't want to sit in a living room that's trashed. You know, I'm going to do my work. It's like, you know, it's a silly analogy, but it's kind of that. So engaging with that, but also reframing the idea that this work is a slog. This work is so difficult. It's like, you know, I'd rather have a Tesla than some Ford that's pumping out a bunch of carbon dioxide into the world. It's like, actually, we need to reframe it of this is a good space to be in. I love how my garden looks because of the composting that I do. You know, I love that my kids are really engaged in talking about climate change and how it makes them feel, but also what they're doing about it. So we can reframe it in a way that doesn't alienate people, because there's always space to have a connection. Everyone, I think, can agree that they'd rather be on a beach that's clean than filled with plastic pollution.
I think that is true. It's a mindset. Again, we keep falling back on this idea. So hang on, let's now talk about the people you've seen who have reached out. So I guess they've identified in themselves that something was, and that comes into kind of more my side of things. You know, I'd like to know how you, through those patients, have you seen some signs and symptoms, I would say, even physical. So obviously we know the signs of anxiety. We could have, you were saying, issues with sleep, issues with breathing properly, digestive issues, all of that. What is there a pattern that is kind of linked more to climate anxiety specifically that you've seen in your patient's physical body?
I think that clients often describe their emotions that sort of harbor in their bodies in a way that's really interesting. And, you know, for some people, it's in their throat because they feel they have something to say, but it can't escape. It's in their chest because they feel this sense of claustrophobia. You know, it's all these people are trying to escape to Mars. It's like, well, it's not, you know, it's that feeling of being trapped in something that we don't have the control over that we'd like to have. So I think that really sits in people's, it also sits in people's hearts, I think. I think people really feel this tension there. And yes, that's anxiety, but I think it also, you know, not to get woo-woo, but I think it also shines light on sort of our, you know, our emotional connection with the world and the people around us and the animals around us and the earth. And I think that it's not, I think we haven't looked enough at sort of indigenous wisdom and in sort of our connection there. And so it's easy to say, well, that's anxiety. That's where that's manifesting in the body. You know, that's actually your, you know, your amygdala signaling there's a problem. It's like, that actually, could we take it a step back and, you know, engage with the science that's going to help us with this, but also just reconnect with the fact that we are entirely a part of this planet.
I couldn't agree more. Do you find, these are kind of maybe odd questions, but that there could be a cleavage. And I feel that sometimes between, for whatever reason, people who want to sit in the denial because they don't want to change, for whatever reason that is, you know, it's too difficult for them, or they think they don't have to. Why me? I didn't do this, whatever, it's their narrative for this. And the people who have decided over time to make that decision and then start implementing the changes that they think is what they can do day to day. And I find that I have felt a bit that in our cases, but I'm not trying to bring this to me. I'm just saying a bit of a ostracization. People say, okay, you know, they are, I'm going to give a silly example because I think it's important for people to realize, you know, we are part of the family and everyone knows that we are maybe a bit engaged on that front and trying to change things. And I know my grandmother has a week of freaking out before we arrive, because she's trying to clean the house of all the things she thinks we will spot on, you know, like, and of course it would never come to us. It's not about, you know, doing this, but I know that that triggers. And I guess what you said at the beginning, the fact that it's good because it also means that she will, once she's cleaned up all the plastic bottles, then she's not going to put them back again. She's like, okay, why? I don't really need them. So there's, I guess, a bit of the trigger that is positive, but at the same time, I obviously don't want to create anxiety in my 93-year-old grandmother, you know? So I'm like, how do we manage this? But also, do you think people are starting to, you know, yeah, there's two sides to it, or do you think everyone is coming back into being one side?
I think we won't have a choice, to be honest. And that's the truth of the matter, because right now, you know, we talk about sort of the privilege of worrying about this, but this is something that's already hugely affecting people in MAPA, most affected people in areas. So, you know, I think in the long term, you know, it's undeniable, it's here, but also, the lexicon's changing. I think the movement in young activists has been phenomenal and empowering. And they've also been at the forefront of talking about things like self-care, talking about the emotional impacts of it, both those who are hit directly from climate change, whether it's typhoons or wildfires, but also those who are indirectly affected. And there was a recent study that was just done in the autumn of 2021 by Avast, and it talked about how actually on a global scale, because there hasn't been a lot of research around this yet, it's young, but there were 10,000 young people that were surveyed throughout the world. And it was something that eco-anxiety is identified in all of these people. It's not just a problem for the privileged. In fact, it's actually more likely to rank higher if you are sort of on the direct path of climate, so wildfires, typhoons. But what we also know that's really amazing about this is I think it's 3/4 of the British population are deeply concerned about climate change. The WHO just said that this is, you know, the most imminent threat that we face. But there's also a huge correlation between activism and climate anxiety. So we see that people are actually taking climate action because they're scared, which is, you know, and we want people to sort of strike the balance. We always talk about sustainable climate action for your mental health and the planet, because what we want is everyone doing this for the long term. And so again, that little anxiety promotes activism, promotes connections, promotes positive emotions too, that we don't talk about enough.
Do you think now, especially that you've written a book, we talk about this all the time, you know, the access to information and obviously education. It seems that the next generation obviously has to be, you know, it has to be embedded in them that we are part of this planet Earth. We have only one Pachamama is one thing, you know. And I guess we're lucky to see it. It happens. Do you think it's fast enough? Do you know what is the reticence in the schooling system to talk about this, if any? And now that you've obviously you become very legit in this space, do you go to schools? Do you feel invited in to try and share this with the little ones?
Absolutely. So we've actually just finished our second book that's for young people on managing climate anxiety. So it's one of those things where I think that because we've talked about sort of the disinformation campaigns and just the polarity that exists in the world right now, this isn't, it was really interesting. I was flagged up on social media the other day for sort of posting something that was controversial, and it was a science fact. And I thought, oh, just because I've mentioned climate change, this is suddenly a political issue. And so I think what we need to do is, again, look into those narratives. And because sort of the young people's movement behind Fridays for Future and things like this, it's swept through in a way that I think, many people are, appalled at the lack of climate science that's happening in the schools. And it depends on school to school. I actually worked with a school that said, oh, they didn't want to engage in the climate conversations because it was seen to be political. And, so there is this push against for some people, but there also are very positive undercurrents of it coming up. I think the BBC or BBC Bite Size just pulled off all of the, what's the positive spin to climate change? So that kind of information is not being tolerated anymore. They're also the GCSE in the UK. I think there's now a climate science degree that you can do. So it is coming through. But again, the more we experience these firsthand disasters, the less likely people are able to turn the other cheek.
How do you think can people still be really deeply in denial?
Again, it's part of broken systems that they've been, they've been told that it's an infringement on their civil rights to not be able to drive, freedom to not be able to have meat for every meal, to not be able to drive diesels everywhere, and actually, I think that's sort of a real possibility to start engaging in really positive climate conversations, because my dad's not, my dad's a very scientific man, but he, It wasn't until I started talking about how great my electric car was and how great my garden was, and suddenly he's gone from being an all-American, 4x4 driving, meat-eating guy to now he's, he's composting, he's installed solar panels, so we talk about sort of nudge economics and nudging people towards better decisions.
May I say something? This is something that really we speak a lot about this sensoriality. I think that when we have stretched the idea of cognitive abilities further than what we can feel, by feeling sense, what you can touch, see, taste, it is then a projection, right? So for, I take an example, but if someone tells me, are you sad because of the tsunami in Japan? I have empathy because I'm a human, but I know, I don't know any Japanese people there. No Japanese people know me. No one loves each other. Why would I be touched? And if it was 50 years ago, I wouldn't even know about it because that's too far. It's not in my realm of cognitive abilities. So I'm thinking it's the same thing here. I find a lot of the time we are asking people to have a view on something so big that they can't grasp with their senses. It's also, it's an idea. And this is interesting when you say about your dad, because this is the thing. Once suddenly he can touch it. There's a story that his daughter is giving him. Then he's doing, you can see your garden, you know, suddenly it becomes tangible. And therefore you can take action on something that is tangible rather than just an idea. Some people can act on ideas, but I feel not that many. So,
and it needs to be easy, you know, and it needs to be, it's like, it's okay for climate action to be easy and to be, but again, we talk about this sort of diagram of impact, ease, and meaning. And when you have all those three components, that center joint is where all the climate action is really going to be long-term and sustainable. Because if we anchor to a certain action means to us, if we're able to make it as impactful as possible, and it's quite easy, that then suddenly there's these shifts that can occur, and those shifts swell out. There's something called the solar panel effect that I love. That's basically there's one person in the neighborhood that's willing to be the pariah, willing to be different and stick their neck out, and they install a solar panel, and then they start talking about how, oh gosh, yeah, we're not paying anything on our energy. How much did you pay? Oh gosh, I remember when that was. Ooh. And then all of a sudden, you just see them just going outwards, and there's these huge communities that have installed them. And that works in so many ways through climate action.
I'm not going to ask you to resume your book in 5 minutes. I'm not going to do that. But you explained to us really nicely why and how you came to write it. And I know you co-wrote it with your partner, Dr. Patrick Kennedy Williams. It's written right there. Tell me, what was the process of writing this and how, because obviously there's research as you write it, research kind of moves forward, so you always feel I'm a bit, you know, I'm not up to date with things. But also, what was the process in you? You know, what are you? I mean, you're proud of it, I know, and you should be. But how do you? What's your emotion with your book, and what would you like people to take away from it, apart from the information? And I'm here. We're in the section of more what to do tips, and I just want to show a lovely picture of you guys at the back here. This is Dr. Becky. Tell me what you think of what would you hope for people to read and come out and put it down, and then what would you like them to do, their first action after it?
You know, I think so to answer the first part of your question, why we wrote this book, how the process was for us, again, it was looking at the climate crisis and identifying who we are in that story, what our characters are, how we can have some, you know, the biggest impact. Again, love that little diagram. But, and what's going to be easiest for us? Well, this is the stuff that we know. This is the stuff that we know works for people. For us, the most important thing was, like, there was sort of no way not to write the book. You know, we felt like it was too important for our kids and for our planet and for the, you know, people all over the world that, you know, we need everybody working on this, but we need people doing it for the long term in a way that's sustainable for them, but also helps their mental health and actually leading to people not just doing the climate work and slugging through it, but thriving in it and tapping into all the positive emotions that are available there, like connecting with others, connecting with nature, you know, feeling motivated, feeling proud, feeling like they are making a difference, and feeling, you know, more empowered to, you know, push against those systems that need that buck.
So I guess that's positive coping tools, I guess.
Yeah, love exactly.
That. Do you, okay, three kind of questions straight to you. What would you want your legacy to be, Megan, with, not that you're going to die tomorrow.
Oh gosh, do you know something I don't?
So, I'm thinking, you know, but I know this is it's a wide question, but I'm trying to, you know, what are we leaving behind? Because once you engage like you are as an author in that space, obviously you're hoping for change, otherwise you wouldn't do it. But
I think it's just to have that snowball effect of as many people doing really good, important climate work and feeling good about it as possible.
What would you say, if there was a platform that you could reach out to all humans, what would you say to them?
I guess it's buy my book. No, I'm just kidding.
Exactly.
But I think it's just connect with nature and remember that we are intrinsically a part of one system. We're all connected. We need to think about what we take from the planet and what we give back.
I like that. And what would you say, because this is where I am and we have this discussion a lot at home. I believe a lot in politics. And what I mean by this is that, I know these are such silly examples, but when we said, well, I wasn't, you can't smoke in cinemas. You won't be able to smoke in restaurants. You won't be able to smoke here and there. People are like, what? That's my freedom. We're going back to this. It's my right. Da, 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 da. And then suddenly the law happens. Boom, from that day, you're not allowed. And then 6 months later, people are like, yeah, that's fine. And then 2 years later, what? You were smoking in cinemas? And when now I say to my son, who's 13, when I was 15 or 16, I used to smoke in planes. It's like, he can't believe it, right? It's just,
yeah.
And I think same with whatever, the seatbelt, these kind of things. So we know this. We know that actually laws do work, right? People do follow them because that's how the society seems to work. Why are we not changing laws faster? Because we know there's no time, right? We know this. So I feel there's so slow.
I couldn't agree more. And again, I think this is where we put that blame back where it's rightly deserved. And that's on the systems in place, the financial systems that control politics, that do the lobbying, that do the sort of work to minimize, the impact that laws could have. I think what can come from that is actually people recognizing the opportunity in green technology, the opportunity in, we should be looking at just sort of the inequality that exists and the intersection of environmentalism and racism and social justice. There's so much there. It's like actually, and health completely.
Mental, as you mentioned, but physical
health as well. Yeah. And it's actually like, this is a huge opportunity to create jobs. There's where was it? I'm trying to remember. I think it was in China. They're doing they did this mass tree planting operation where they suddenly were creating loads of jobs and planting forests. It's like, you can't do better than that. You can't, but it's a great opportunity. So if we actually, again, spun the narrative of not taking something away, but suddenly you're providing jobs, you're providing cheaper energy, you're providing better made products, and making it, a financially viable thing too. I'm not saying do business as normal, but actually that's where then politicians start to listen and start to pay attention. Also, we can have the impact with our votes, voting with our wallets, but also voting with our, democratic votes.
I'm just trying to, coming back to you as a practitioner here, as a psychologist and coach, when people approach you for whatever they're feeling that is they want to help with, how long does it take? I know it's a bit of a weird question because everyone's singular, we know this, but what would you say to them? Listen, we're going to identify where in your specific case things came along. What is it? Is it from your context, your circles, yourself, etc., your history? And then you put in place, I guess, some, as you say, positive coping tools, and you shape that in their life so they can use it and get along and find this balance between denial and a bit of anxiety so that they do stuff. So how long would that take? Is it one session? Is it 10 sessions? Is it, do you tell them, okay, I'm going to hold you and we go back and forth for 6 months? How do you structure it?
I think it's such a nice sort of marriage is kind of like the therapeutic side of it and also the coaching side, I think, because actually we're able to sort of look at when we're talking about sort of on an individual basis, actually it's appropriate for some people to do therapy first, or for some people it's like, I just have these four projects that I need to do. I need coaching and I need to be directed. And so it's very flexible in that sense. And, you know, I think it, for some people, it's a session. For some people, it's a chat. For some people, it's I need you to help me hold myself accountable for the next 6 months because I have this long-term goal. And so it's one of those things that it's really, you know, it's where we start is normalizing the emotions. We do the cliche thing of how does that make you feel? You know, the psychologist question of the year. But then also we move on to say, what are you going to do about it? And that's really important for us.
And that's nice that you and Paddy, in a way, Paddy being your partner, you know, one-stop shop, you know, he is also the clinical psychologist, you're the coaching, you know, you can have, it's a nice combination of you both. And now to wrap it up a little bit, can you, I'm really excited by your book. I'm really excited for people for buying it. I'm really excited for also corporations and or governments, obviously, but also organizations, private organizations, you know, businesses to approach people like you to deal with the mental health of their employees, but also to guide them towards changing the top thinking on what they are, what their impact is, and how does work. So how do you approach that? Do they come now to you because you're famous, or do you still have to go and grind and knock on doors?
We've actually, you know, we've been approached, and this has been staggering, just the variety of different organizations that have come to us. I mean, it's everything from banking communities to film and cinema for a consultation on how to write in narratives about climate change. And there's just always the opportunity to have that conversation. Within organizations, it's been really good because everyone's making the move towards sustainability and they're really being pressured to do so. For us, it's about ensuring that that's not greenwashing. It's ensuring that the people that are, you know, within the organization, the sustainability team of the organization, are supported with their mental health processes and the best sort of communication tools to have the biggest success within their organization. Because, you know, they might be really ambitious and say, okay, let's change this. And then computer says no. It's like, actually, how do they push back? How do they express how important this is? So it's been a wonderful process of working through such a wide variation of people from all over the world. And that really gives us such such hope and optimism, because, you know, there's just everywhere you look, there's something new cropping up, whether it's young activists or, you know, the banking industry going green.
I want to finish by saying two things. First of all, what I love about you and you guys and the book and you now is that you're really hopeful. And I know that this is not just you putting this on because it's the way we should be to try and engage with people. It's the truth. And you've just said it now, you know, and we see it. It's nice to be feeling that you're engaging with climate change today, where there is actually places and people to resonate with and speak about. Because imagine if we were to feel really this way 50 years ago. My God, you must have had, you know, the frustration of trying to say, guys, I'm not sure you're doing the right thing here for the planet. And people are saying, yeah, you know, no place for you to say anything.
But that still exists. And for a lot of people, they feel like there's no one to talk to about it, no one that understands how they feel. And what's great about sort of the social media revolution and Zoom and things like that, actually, there's suddenly climate cafes popping up. There's there are communities, there's support networks. So suddenly it's like, actually, this is there. So our advice is always find your tribe.
Or if you can't find it, you can find this one. Here it is. Megan, just to finish, tell us where and how can we find your book, please?
So Jennifer Kingsley Publishing, it has both US, UK, and Australia distribution, also your local lovely bookstore. And if they don't have it, ask them for it and they'll order it.
Yes. Thank you so Megan. Much. Thank you so much. I'm so lucky to have that.
Such a pleasure.
I can't wait to see where this will go and bring even more people to understand and obviously more people to reach out to you. And hopefully, obviously, it's great to have singular people, but I think that, you know, if corporations, hopefully government, schools, and private organization can just come and listen and learn and change, we're on for something hopefully good. Megan, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I really hope that we'll get more people to read your book. I'm very excited by even the second one. Ooh. can mind do another another chat about that.
We'll
say goodbye for now. Thank you everyone for joining. I hope you enjoy that, and please go and get this book. À bientôt. Thank you, Megan.
Thank you.
Ciao.